The True False podcast is made possible with the support of the University of Missouri and the Donald W. Reynolds Journalism Institute.
Welcome to the True False Film Festival.
As far as I'm concerned, he should take his family and disappear deep and far into the Amazon jungle where he belongs.
Welcome to the True False podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofeld. In this episode, we talk with filmmaker Sandy Tan, who made the movie Shirkers, which will feature at this year's fest. Tan made her first feature film at the age of 16, with the help of her best friends, including a middle-aged mentor named George. The film was ambitious, experimental, and it was never to be seen.
That movie was called Shirkers, a word which means running away, avoiding responsibility, escape.
Then George disappeared, taking the more than 700 minutes of footage with him. 2 decades later, Tan searches for answers in her documentary, also called Shirkers. I was wondering if you were ever considering naming it something other than Shirkers, since that was what the original film was called.
It needed to be called Shirkers just because it's about that film, but it's also about running away from this. It's like having this great gap in my life that I'm filling in and for myself because I shirked everything. And I thought, there's no better name for this film than to call it Shirkers as well, because it's a meta commentary on everything that's been since. You know, it's a playful title. I think it means something kind of irresponsible and youthful back then. And I think, strangely enough, like, it feels the same now. I just feel a sudden kind of joyful irreverence and with a sense of closure, I guess, as well to the whole episode. I'm older. I got my friends back together for this. There's a sudden kind of beautiful, closure to that escapist adventure. And I'm doing it again, but it's a larger, more grown-up, global version of the original story.
You mentioned your friends. Had you talked to them recently, or was this, what was it like to get them back together for this film?
Okay, so Jasmine, who is my frenemy.
and you sort of say as much in the film, right?
It's, you know, like, that's a long time ago, being, friends, you know, like, with this very difficult person. And it's, I think all women have that, probably. Most women have this kind of complicated friendship with a another person who's kind of like a sister, and it's, you're so close to them during this time of when you were young, and then you kind of like grow up in different cities around the world, and but you still like continue the same conversation, like you hadn't kind of broken out of that horrible those conflicts you were fighting about when you were 14, they still are there in some different form, even though you haven't seen them in years and years, and you can talk to them. And it's like you're continuing the same conversation. Hmm. I guess that makes her more like a sister than a friend, maybe. I don't know. But then it cuts both ways. You're also equally like, I mean, you're just much more brutal with each other. So I'm glad that the film kind of reflects this kind of relationship, long friendship, I guess, and people see themselves in it and can recognize it, because it's very rare that people have that, you know, caught that on screen, where people can persuade or ambush their frenemy into being part of this thing.
So the film starts out with you being a very present, vocal, first-person narrator. And then when we get to this part where you're with George and you're kind of uncovering what his deal was and what his motivations might have been, and your tone in the form shifts a bit. I feel like you are a passenger, writing in the passenger seat rather than the driver's seat a little bit. Though, mm-hmm. of course, you're still driving. You're the filmmaker. Yeah. Can you talk about that?
I feel like that's the part of the film where I guess it's you're growing up and you're going on the journey to, you know, figure this big mystery out, and you, you know, the music changes, the rhythm, everything was deliberately different, where you calm down a little bit and sort of sort out these things that kind of ate up your youth and left you, not a shell of a person, but a different person than you might have been. You're no longer kind of doing the frenzied, you know, personal in your head thing. You have to expand now outside of your head and go and find out what actually happened. And that was a deliberate switch in tone.
Yeah. And was there ever a moment where you felt like you were reluctant to spend so much time with George or have him occupy so much of the airspace? Because almost for me as a viewer, I was angry with him by that point in the film. And I was like, no, he doesn't get the narrative. Why does he get to, you know? Yeah, but also I did want to know what happened. So
like my meta thing of like the way of kind of like reflecting the way it was experienced for us, mm-hmm. which is that he kind of hijacked the film. He hijacked our lives by stealing the film. And, you know, if we kind of found closure by solving this mystery of why and what and, you know, when and who, then he doesn't get to steal it away forever. And so after this episode, in which he hijacks the narrative a little bit, we kind of take it back again away from him, mm-hmm. and just don't give it, you know, we kind of close it on ourselves. It's our story in the end. We take it back from him, but we do have to, because it is a great mystery. I think it's, it is still, I think it fascinates me still, the fact that, you know, he was a man that was made up of stories. He was a man who didn't leave a lot of traces in terms of solid, like concrete creations. In fact, he never actually completed anything. In fact, his life was the creation. I find it extremely fascinating to, because it's not just a portrait of me, this film. It's a portrait of me and him. You know, so I actually tracked my psychological devolution, should I say, over those years, including some of the emotional arcs that are important to this film, like my great anger and disappointment when the film was taken away from us, and just like the rage, you know, like now that I'm a placid person who lives many continents away, and you know, many decades have gone by and things have moved on, and I feel like I'm not as virulently angry or upset about it. But reading these letters, I mean, I was always very humorous about it. But you were
angry. Yeah. I mean, understandably, your project went missing.
Could I just read you one paragraph from one of these things?
I would love that. Yeah.
So this is my it's in the film too, but in a different form. This was this letter I wrote to Jasmine, like, you know, like a year after the film was stolen from us by George. But this is the way I was actually proud of myself for having some kind of distance. And the way I find, I guess, salvation, psychological salvation for myself would be to seek refuge in movies and movie cliches. And so this is like how I expressed it. I said, I envisage some measure of a showdown with pyrotechnics and slick editing and spurred boots stomping in the desert sand. I want him in a building, and I am sprinting away from it. And just as I dive out of frame, the building bursts into light and collapses in on itself, like those demon houses in 70s scary movies. As far as I'm concerned, he should take his family and disappear deep and far into the Amazon jungle where he belongs, amongst his distinct relation, the buck-tooth boa. Lowlife. And that was how I expressed it. I mean, it's just, I was full of rage.
Coming up after the break, Tan talks about how the work of making this documentary changed how she came to view George.
I'm so much more sympathetic to him than I was 25 years ago. I see his humanity.
First, a word from our sponsors. Hey, listeners, it's Allison, letting you know that this episode of the True False podcast is brought to you by the University of Missouri. That is, in fact, where we are making the show right now. We're here in the KBIA studios at the University of Missouri School of Journalism, which is famous for the Missouri Method. Here to tell us what the heck the Missouri Method is our podcast producer and MU journalism student, Abby Ivory Gagne.
Hey.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
What's been like a highlight for you?
I came in for a reporting shift one day. It was my second ever. And I got assigned a breaking story and I followed it. And then the next morning I was in line at Starbucks when somebody texted me and said they heard my story on NPR.
Sounds like you're getting a lot of good experience. Thanks, Abby.
Thanks, Allison.
And we also want to thank the University of Missouri, home to the Missouri Method, for their generous support of this podcast. This episode of the True False podcast is brought to you by the Donald W. Reynolds Journalism Institute. Here to tell us more is the RJI Executive Director, Randy Picht. Hey, Randy.
Hey, Allison.
Can you tell us what are the RJI Fellowships?
They're a great opportunity for folks in the industry that have big ideas or innovative ideas that they want to try to bring to journalism. And they're a great way for RJI to work on its mission of helping journalism have a long and bright future. Our fellows work on innovative projects that could involve new strategies for the industry, and not necessarily just from journalism. We're always very interested in interdisciplinary projects. We've worked with artists, technologists, entrepreneurs, along with folks from the New York Times and the Washington Post. If it's a good idea that we think can help journalism, sign us up.
That sounds awesome, especially the interdisciplinary part. Are there any projects that you've gotten to witness that you're really excited about?
We did one with an artist that tried to create a piece that could run in the paper that people could take home and frame. It was about gun control. A lot of the interdisciplinary projects get involved with engagement, and we like to think that RJI offers the most flexible journalism fellowships around.
Very Midwestern of us.
That's right.
The True False podcast is sponsored by the Reynolds Journalism Institute. You can find out more at rjionline.org. That's rjionline.org. Welcome back to the True False podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofeld. Let's get back to my interview with Sandy Tan. Tan's film, Shirkers, follows her journey as she pieces together what happened to the lost footage of a film she made more than two decades ago. Do you feel now, do you feel comfortable with the amount of presence you have in the film, or is that still something that you feel uncomfortable with?
I just never wanted to be captured on camera. It was, you know, I think that the experience of doing Shirkers, the 1992 version in which I was a teenage zombie. I mean,
And the star of the film.
A teenage zombie. It was horrifying. And I just was so, I've been like just avoiding cameras and whatever. And I just really, really never wanted to be on video. And those like, it was like, you know, looking through my collection of things to look for just images of myself was very difficult because there was so little of it. So I was so panicked about, you know, being caught.
So did
in
you
any form that's permanent?
Did you never want to hear or see yourself before Shirkers?
The
first round of Shirkers?
I was always kind of camera shy.
Okay.
I was trained. Well, we went to drama school, and we were trained for. I mean, I guess we were like stage people, acting, whatever. I just, you know, and that was like, you know, completely impermanent, one-offs. I was just horrified at being caught in a permanent state of expressionlessness.
Why did you decide to? I mean, then
because yeah, that was the only person who could do the role.
Right.
It was me. It was,
yeah.
You know, and there was a part of me that just wanted to do it anyway. but But I just knew that it was a horrible performance because it was a role that was a non-role, as I said. You know, it was like this cipher. It was, you know, also like I was completely, at that point, I was obsessed with Bruno S., who's this non-actor kind of freak that Werner Herzog liked to use, and he used them in The Enigma of Caspar Hauser. He was a non-acting German, I guess he was German, person who, you know, and so his name was Bruno S., S for this long last name. And so I took on S because I was a version of him doing a kind of a non-performance. That was my idea anyway. Of course, when you actually play it, it just looks like you're not acting very well. But yeah, I was definitely horrified, and I was really reluctant to make this. When I began making this film, I didn't know it was going to be a personal film. I just didn't want to go there. I just thought I could be objective about it, about Shirkers and everything else. But then I was working with Inat Sidi. She's this great documentary editor. She worked on The Wolfpack, and she worked on One of Us. And she was, you know, she was initially working with me early on, and she did my development reel, and we talked about how to approach this project. And every day she would like email me and yell at me to look at my archive. You have to make video diaries. You have Sandy. It's about you. It's about you. and she just like bludgeoned me into realizing that there was no way I could make this film unless I exposed myself or realized that it was my story. So I owe a lot to her. I realize as I'm making the film, and I'm just, you get inured. You just have to, so you don't think about it that way. And then there were so many versions of me. You know, there's a version of me now. There's a version of filmmaker me looking back at me when I was, you know, a teenager. And then I have to think, like, when I was a teenager, there was me playing S in the film, but and then there was also me, the person who wrote the script, and the person who made all these, who had these crazy ideas and had these friendships, and who went through all those crazy things. There was the outside me then and the inside me then, and then there's the filmmaker now, and the me now that's not the filmmaker. And there were so many versions of me that eventually when I looked at the footage, it's like, it's just like me looking at this, I'm just thinking, that poor person giving such a horrible performance, and I'm just like looking at it as me, as somebody else. It's a very strange thing that happens during the process, and it's in the same way that when you're writing a book, you have the writer part of you who's writing the thing, and then when you come and edit, you have a different head. So it's actually very liberating. To be a different person.
You know, you've written a book. One of your other works includes a novel called The Black Isle. It also has to do with ghosts, and it's, well, first of all, it's so interesting to me that this film feels like a memoir, and then the book is this novel, but they both have this through line of real life kind of ghosts.
Yeah. So the book is kind of a first person, you know, grandiose memoir of the 20th century told by an old woman in Asia who is, you know, begins as a coming of age thing where she comes to grips with, you know, her extraordinary ability, which is that she's not afraid of ghosts. And she eventually becomes a ghost hunter because one of her, I guess, antagonists, you know, friends who... This really good friend of hers that comes in is this very enigmatic, very charismatic man who becomes her really close, I guess, friend for many years. And, you know, there's parts of him, this other character that has shades of George, I guess, in it. So writing it, I channeled their rapport pretty easily, and you know, you track this kind of a sick friendship through decades, and that was fun to write.
Yeah. Do you feel like you've reached a turning point with ghosts? Are you still fascinated with ghosts, or what's your relationship to ghosts?
I was, you know, when you write a book that is I guess, kind of a has thriller elements and is kind of a giant epic ghost story. I was like literally kind of a scaredy cat about scary things.
Me too.
But like when you have to kind of write those scenes and make them be scary on the page, which is very, very difficult to do. I actually got over my fear of a lot of, you know, spooky creaks and, you know, idea of ghosts in the house and things like that. But I think that's one way of exercising a lot of the things that are, that trouble you. And so like in making this film, I hate to say, like, I am so much more freed of the idea of George and the idea of this my youth having been taken away from me by this one person, by his act, than I was when I started thinking about making this film. It's like a 3-year therapeutic process. Mm-hmm. Where you just work through these things, and I'm so much more sympathetic to him than I was 25 years ago. I see his humanity. I actually don't think of him as a villain in the classic sense, which is, a lot of people think of him as a villain, and he, what he did was horrible. But you know, with all our mentors who are not entirely good, you know, we did get something from him, and eventually, like 25 years later, even though we went through a lot of trouble in the interim, I actually got this film from him in a strange way. Like the fact that he did this to us, has allowed me to tell the story in this way. But at the same time, watching the film, I realized the people who are most cheated, I think, are the people who acted in Shirkers in 1992. Yeah. There were some great performances that we captured by people they were all kind of non-actors, but some of them had ambition and they could have had different lives if the film had been completed and their performances shared with the world. And I felt like they had their careers as well kind of stolen away into a vacuum, and that was extremely wicked of George to have done that. And he did that out of, various reasons, one of which undoubtedly was jealousy and feeling threatened that these kids were so ambitious and were pulling off something he could never have done himself.
Yeah, it's really, in some ways, this film is your full circle from that experience. And it's a true shame that those other people that worked so hard on it were robbed of that.
Yeah, and hopefully, which is why I'm eager to share this film with them, and they're gonna bring their talents to light and just have them feel that it was worth dreaming, it was worth pursuing, it was worth being a crazy kid. I mean, basically, it's always worth being a crazy kid.
That's it for this episode of the True False podcast. You can find more of our conversations with filmmakers at kbia.org, in iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, leave us a review. It'll help other people find this show. Thanks to Sandy Tan for the interview. It was really fun. This episode was produced by Aviva Oakson-Haberman and edited by Bram Sablesmith and Ryan Van Mulliner. The song you heard was Marissa Anderson's Into the Light. Our introduction was created by Tim Pilcher using sounds from the True False Film Fest. We hope to see you downtown here at True False, March 1st through 4th, 2018, and join us next time as we discuss a different aspect of the art and craft of nonfiction storytelling. I'm Allison Kofeld. Thanks for listening.